its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We're glad you're here today. We talk about summer festivals coming up later this hour. And as we edge our way closer to Father's Day weekend, we've got some Father's Day content here for you tomorrow we think you'll like. Also, Lansing Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon joins us tomorrow here on Current State. Michigan House Speaker Jace Bolger would appear to be the man of the hour here at the Capitol. And Speaker Bolger joins us in just a few minutes as well. We hope you can stick around. Recently, the nation's become focused on a series of scandals emanating from the nation's capital. Most recently, Edward Snowden, an analyst with the National Security Agency, publicly disclosed details of a secret telephone data mining program. That disclosure came shortly after news that the Internal Revenue Service had targeted and allegedly harassed Tea Party groups. Today we're going to discuss those and other issues with a first-time guest to Current State, Republican U.S. Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan's 7th District. Congressman Walberg, welcome to Current State.
Well, good morning. It's good to be on with you.
Many people from all over the political spectrum have weighed in on how to regard NSA analyst Edward Snowden's actions after his disclosure of the phone data mining program. What do you think? Is he a hero or a traitor?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell. The issue in hand is how he carried it out. If he had concerns about what was going on there, there were other methods that he could have taken, including going to the sponsor of the Patriot Act, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, who has, because of that effort, has all knowledge and secret access and clear characterizations that he could work with. So it remains to be seen. However, with all of the scandals that are going on, for this to come out at this point in time makes it of even higher priority. And so we're looking at it carefully to find out, first of all, whether or not the law has been violated by the NSA, whether they've overstepped their bounds in mining information, or whether they are using it appropriately, but now it has been characterized alongside of these scandals in a way that makes it more negative. So our country has to be protected, but that includes our civil rights, and those are the issues top at hand right now.
I read in the New York Times yesterday that most likely the Times speculated that Snowden could very well be charged with disclosure of classified information under the Espionage Act, and that carries a possible 10-year jail term for each count. I guess Mr. Snowden broke that agreement, broke an agreement that he made to keep those materials secret.
Well, it very well could be, and that's the concern. You know, in talking with my good friend and colleague Mike Rogers, who represents the area where you sit right now, Mike understands the law as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, understands the concerns that are there, and the priorities of making sure that, number one, we keep our citizens safe from terrorist acts, and we have means in place to do that. But I know for a fact that Mike concerns himself very clearly with civil rights issues, too. He has expressed great concern over what Mr. Snowden did, that it was inappropriate the way he did it, and that indeed it could be treasonous.
Well, what do you make of the praise that Snowden is getting from some conservatives? I mean, Glenn Beck and Ron Paul have both praised him. Beck called him a hero.
Well, Ron Paul has a little more insight on what goes into this type of information and the top secret nature that is there, or the classified information, how you handle it. Glenn Beck certainly doesn't. He does not come in contact. He has not been given classified clearance. He doesn't understand the full extent. However, he, as a citizen, does have responsibility in continually watching over, as a citizen watchdog, like we all ought to be, of our government. And so I think right now restraint has to be there, but also an intentionality of saying we must get to the bottom of this this issue. My concern is that not that the responsibility for NSA and other intelligence gathering organizations have the responsibility of finding the needle in the haystack. My concern is how large of a haystack we make, and if this has gone beyond using the law, the Patriot Act, FISA courts, and all of that, using the law to develop a haystack that is huge in mining potential of data and information. Have we gone beyond what's necessary? There are some that say that, and some who have in-depth knowledge of how intelligence gathering is done have indicated that this has gone beyond what is necessary, in fact, to a danger zone. And that's what my responsibility and the members of Congress in oversight capacities are responsible to find out now.
You'll be taking a position, though?
I will take a position at some point in time. Right now, the information is too sketchy to know.
Okay.
I supported the Patriot Act. I support the FISA courts, but only as defined in the law, and they are given very strict parameters on how they are carried out. And we want to make sure that's followed. If those are followed, I think our civil rights are safe in the creative tension that we have of also protecting ourselves against terrorist action. If the FISA courts, the Patriot Act have been used by the NSA and others beyond legal limits, then we have to stop that and action must be taken.
I'd like to get your response to remarks of your House colleague, Peter King, Republican of New York, who told Anderson Cooper back on Tuesday night that action should also be taken against reporters who knowingly publish classified information. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree if it's knowingly. However, I still believe in the First Amendment that it is the responsibility of a free media, a free press, to put information, full information, out to the public. But in turn, they have a responsibility to understand that there are classified things for national security we have to watch out for. But primarily, that's responsibility of people like myself, NSA people, and others to not give classified information or top secret information to media. So again, the onus, the major burden is on the government and government officials like myself to not give away classified information and violate the law ourselves.
Right.
It's not the responsibility primarily of the media that's supposed to be watching us, supposed to be reporting the facts. And so in the case of the Fox News reporter being challenged right now, the bottom line is he was reporting. And if someone gave him, who knowingly understood it to be classified or top secret information, that's their fault, and they should be prosecuted for it.
Gotcha. I want to move on to immigration reform here for a second. We're talking with Michigan Congressman Tim Walberg from the 7th District. Debate is about to begin in the Senate on a much-publicized immigration overhaul. President Obama calls the measure a compromise. He says nobody's going to get everything that they want. Have you looked at the Senate measure? And if so, how do you feel about it?
Well, I've looked at the Senate measure. I also reserve final statement on it until we see what it actually becomes, and that's going to take place in its deliberation, the amendment process, the debate that goes on, and maybe even some filibuster that takes place.
I filibuster to take place?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Knowing the emotional nature of that issue, plus the firebrands in the Senate that have already shown, such as Rand Paul, a willingness to step up and use filibuster where capable, who knows what might take place. The issue, though, I think in a meeting with both House and Senate members last week, it became very clear that it is so true that if we could get past the emotional issue, and I think also the concrete issue of securing our borders to the point that the general American public feels like we have done the key responsibility, making sure that our borders are secure, and then that we have gates that open for freedom and opportunity and the American dream to citizens from other countries who want to come, like my grandmother and grandfather and father who came over to this country and said, we want what America has to offer and we want to be part of that, that's a good thing. And so if we take that emotional issue out of whether our borders are secure or not, and we show the people that we've done that first, I think it opens up all sorts of opportunity for a very good and positive approach to saying immigration is a good thing. It creates a greater country. It provides more creativity, more opportunity, and that's a process that we can then enter into.
Could that lead, could an offer of a tighter border lead to your support for a pathway to citizenship. Is that conceivable?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you have to define the term pathway to citizenship. My understanding of pathway to citizenship is coming through in illegal means with a bureaucracy that is reduced in size, that looks at the just key concerns and allows people to go through without giving a restrictive nature to the point that they decide, I don't want to be illegal, but that's the only way I'm ever going to provide for my family and give me the opportunity that America affords. I'm open to looking at all means by which we can produce a better immigration system for those that yearn to be free, plus the citizens who are already here, so that we know we're all on the same playing field, living by the same rules, and experience all the same greatness of what this country can offer us.
Let's just go just a little bit deeper into the detail here, because a pathway to citizenship is on the table for the 11 million or so undocumented foreigners in exchange, immigrants in exchange for a host of changes, including a tighter border. It would apparently require any illegal immigrant embarking on the pathway to citizenship to pay taxes and a penalty, to learn English, and then go to the back of the line behind applicants who want to enter the country lawfully. The president has said the average wait would be 13 years. Collectively, you're encouraged by that balance of provisions?
Well, that balance of provisions, as you say, you have to look more carefully at it. Most of those people, at the earning capabilities they have right now, won't be paying taxes anyway. We have citizens at those same earning capabilities who aren't paying any federal tax. And if they are, generally they are getting that totally refunded to them. So we have to make sure we understand that in most cases, that language adds nothing to the tax rolls. Secondly, many of those people we're talking about giving a pathway to citizenship aren't necessarily asking for citizenship. Many are simply asking for a temporary work opportunity. Many of them will go back, as a number of agriculture workers in my district who come and work on a specific farm every summer and fall season, and then go back to their home in Mexico, in this case, what I'm thinking of, and that's exactly how they want it to be. They are coming, of course, on an H-2 program. They're coming legally, but they don't want citizenship. They just want opportunity, and they want to provide the service they're looking for. So I think we need to look at what the language is actually saying, and frankly, it's not clearly stating what the reality is.
Many of the Senate Republicans who voted in favor of the bill that's about to begin a debate seem to view immigration reform as a way to help modernize the politics of the party and generate more support from minorities. What do you make of that position?
Well, I'm not supportive of that position. I don't think that's the reason why we make laws. I think we ought to make a law because it's the right thing to do, not just political.
There is a huge debate going on, though, now about the future of your party and its need to modernize, from no less than party chairman Reince Priebus.
Well, I'm not going to speak for Reince. I'm speaking for myself. I'm a Washingtonian, I guess, in belief that we should never have had parties. We ought to have people who stand on the principles that they believe in and are elected by the people who they will serve on the basis of those positions. But we have parties, and so I live within the confines of what is real, and that's the fact that I'm closer to a Republican than anything else. But the bottom line, we ought to be thinking about the Constitution. We ought to be thinking about what our responsibility is for government. We ought to be limiting government, giving more freedom and opportunity, as well as accountability with responsibility. And I think in doing that, we will gain the hearts and minds of the general public that says, America is the place I want to live because it espouses limited government, freedom of opportunity, and a chance for all, a chance to succeed as well as a chance to fail, but a government that won't get in the way of getting up and going on. And that's what I would purport that the majority of immigrants want. They're not asking for anything more than that.
Okay.
And our citizens have to get back to understanding that's the best way to live as well, and that's the modern situation that will produce the greatest success in this country.
Republican U.S. Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan's 7th District, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Glad to be on.
its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. A Michigan House committee has approved a much-debated proposal to expand Medicaid coverage in the state. Expansion of the federal program enjoys some bipartisan support, including from Governor Rick Snyder, but the measure had been delayed by some House Republicans who wanted stricter guidelines. Some were also reluctant to approve the expansion because of its connection to the federal Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The measure includes some stricter guidelines, a few meant to incentivize recipients to adopt healthy behaviors. And joining us now to talk about the Medicaid debate and other issues in the legislature, current state welcome speaker of the Michigan House, Republican Jace Bolger. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Good to see you. The measure that came out of the House Competitiveness Committee late yesterday, includes some changes that I have to ask you about. But before we look at those changes in any detail, tell me just how you feel about the measure overall that emerged from the committee yesterday.
I'm very supportive of the measure that emerged from the committee. I think this is the way to go. I think as you talk about, we could talk about a lot of different aspects of this, but I think the bottom line is it produces significant reform, puts people more in control of their healthcare decision. It addresses the competitive issue with regard to if we did nothing, then Michigan would be a further donor state. Michigan taxpayers would be paying for the coverage in other states. It addresses the uncompensated care. It provides greater health care for other individuals and protects taxpayers in the long run.
Are you like the chairman, your fellow Republican chair Mike Shirky of the committee? You've changed your mind as this measure has changed?
I would say we were
hesitant. Resisted this originally, correct?
I called it proper skepticism at the time, a proper concern. And yes, I had deep concern over this issue. And should we move forward? How do we best move forward? How do we best protect Michigan taxpayers? How do we best serve Michigan's citizens? And I think today, this is the best answer. I think this is much better than doing nothing.
Let's listen to Republican Committee Chair Mike Shirky. He, along with three other Republicans, ended up voting for the measure. He originally opposed Medicaid expansion. Let's listen to him explain his change of mind.
But as I spent the last 6 weeks studying it in detail, I determined that the downsides of doing nothing were worse than the upsides of being active.
That pretty much mirrors your position on the issue as well?
It does.
Okay. A new requirement that enrollees pick up some expenses after 6 months is one of the changes, and then more after 4 years. Any particular comment on that?
Sure. I think that's a key part. Well, first, people then become more responsible for their own health care. The other thing is then when you have that mechanism, you can then reduce those charges. And you reduce those charges because people follow their doctor's orders and they improve their health care. Today, and here I think is an essential part of the conversation, the goal should not be to simply cover more people, to have a government program cover more people. The goal should be to improve people's individual health. And so when you have charges and then you can reduce those charges if, say, somebody quits smoking or loses weight and they improve their health care, then if their charges go down, I think that that's a good situation. And that is a situation that can save taxpayer money as well as improve the lives of individuals.
There's a no smoking incentive as well, a chance for participants to cut costs.
Yes,
if they do that.
If they follow their doctor's orders is the bottom line. That's an example that we use.
How is that enforced?
The department would then develop that with the insurance providers, and it would be the individual has to go to the doctor for an initial screening, an initial setup, which I think is very important, that people receive the initial consultation with their doctor, the preventative care. And then the doctor sets benchmarks and says, these are the things you can do to improve your life, to improve your health care. Your premiums, your copays will be this, and that this slides. So it's lower, the lower income, more for higher income. And then if people follow the doctor's orders and improve their health care, then their contribution falls.
And you will share your message of support with your caucus, correct?
Absolutely. I already have.
You already have.
Yes.
Clarify one thing. Does a vote necessarily have to take place today?
It doesn't necessarily have to take place today, but I believe it will take place today.
Okay. And you will vote in favor. All of this assumes the federal government would grant Michigan a waiver and enable it to move ahead. Your fellow Republican, Mike Shirky, told the AP's David Eggert that the HHS, the Federal Health and Human Services, has, quote, reacted favorably to most of what Republicans want to do, though no promises have been made. That was a quote. If the bill moves forward, what's your best understanding as to whether that could happen?
There are two layers of waivers that would need to be. One is in the short term and the other is in the long term. We feel very good. We've been given very good indications from the federal government on the short term. Those are the things that we've been discussing, the individual control, the individual incentives. The second then becomes at 48 months. We want to make sure that for able-bodied adults above 100% of poverty, that they have an incentive to find personal coverage, individual coverage, and so that a government program like this is a temporary hand up and does not become a lifestyle nor an entitlement. And so that requires a second waiver. That would have to take place before December 31st of 2015 to allow that individual who hits 48 months in their 49th month to choose. Do they want to go to the exchange, the federal exchange, and receive the federal subsidy for that? Or do they want to pay a higher premium to remain on Michigan's system?
So do you expect a Medicaid expansion proposal to make it to Governor Snyder's desk?
I do.
Okay. A Michigan Tea Party group has written Governor Snyder telling him that he will not have its support if the state moves forward on this. What do you make of that?
I disagree. I disagree with their statement. I disagree with their approach. I think for those who don't support the direction the federal government is headed, there is a difference in philosophy or a difference in strategy. And the difference is, should we do everything we can to protect Michigan taxpayers, to protect Michigan's citizens, Michigan's patients, or should we stand by and do nothing? And that's the key for the fracture or the disagreement within those within my party is, what's the best way to handle this? What's the best way to protect Michigan citizens? I believe acting on this bill is the best way.
Does losing political support from Tea Party supporters concern you?
Now, let me put it this way. I believe these jobs, these elected offices, are worth running for to do. They're not worth doing so that you can run for them. Meaning it's our job to govern. It's our job to make the decisions on what's best for Michigan's citizens, to stand and be held accountable for those decisions when we face our voters. But we shouldn't be driven by a desire to get reelected.
It would appear they have drawn some kind of line in the sand here, though.
And they're certainly free to do that, and I disagree with their approach.
It would appear the governor's embrace of right to work doesn't mean that much to some conservatives months after the fact. What do you make of that?
Well, several of the people who signed that letter, I believe, have stated that they did not support the governor last time. So they're saying, I didn't support you last time, and I'm not going to support you this
time. Continuing not to support you. hearings continued yesterday.
But I think it's important for the governor and for those legislators so that people understand that we don't make our decision based on what will make us popular in the next 6 months. We make our decision based on what we believe is right for the next decade and the next generation.
Hearings continued yesterday on bills that would allow the state to dissolve insolvent Michigan school districts faster. It's been reported that these are being fast-tracked through the legislature. What would these bills do?
These bills specifically would allow a small district, if it does not have a deficit reduction plan or does not live up to its deficit reduction plan, to be dissolved by the state superintendent and the state treasurer. So these are communities where, in most cases, there's either been gross mismanagement or there's been a mass exodus of the students. The parents and the students are deciding that that school district does not work, and they're fleeing to the neighboring districts. So the district that remains can no longer survive. So what the district, what would happen is the district would be dissolved and the neighboring, the lines would be redrawn for the neighboring school districts so that those students would attend the neighboring school districts.
And that would be a decision of the state superintendent and the state treasurer?
In consultation or in working with, to oversimplify, the local ISD, the local countywide district.
Now, some Republicans say this is quite necessary. Others, like fellow Republican Tom McMillan, say they don't like the fact that they're being, quote, rushed, unquote. Do you feel they're being rushed, and where do you stand?
Certainly, it's a short time frame to deal with such a significant issue. But we're talking about kids and serving those kids, and we're talking about the fall and what will happen for the fall. And to get ready for the fall, we need several months to work for those kids and on those kids' behalf. So at the bottom line is, I believe we need to look out for the kids and how they'll be served in the future, and not the bickering adults.
Before I forget, let's back up and just ask one question related to the Medicaid expansion. Do you have a handle on how long the state is likely to have to wait before they hear from the feds on the waivers?
The first round, so that we can get started, would need to take
place. The first one, yeah.
Would need to take place before the end of the year so that it can be ready to go January 1st of 2014.
Okay. Let's move on to road funding. Where is that right now from your perspective?
We've had several conversations. The quadrant, as it's called, so leaders of both parties in both chambers, the House and the Senate, have had, I think, very constructive conversations. It's too early to call them productive. So at this point, we're sitting around the table asking each other and putting things on the table that people are interested in, that are important, that are priorities, and asking what's the best way to solve this problem. I think there's widespread recognition that we have a $1.2 billion problem, an underinvestment in our roads. That problem will continue to compound, and that will leave a bigger problem for our kids to deal with in the future, much like you can choose to change the oil in your car, or you can choose later to have to replace the engine. So right now, we're debating internally, how do we best solve that problem? And there are, of course, differences of opinion on how to produce that. I think the first step we already saw, and that was a down payment, about a 25% down payment from the existing budget, from existing budget resources to get us started. The next question is
the $350 million?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And so the next question is that the $350 million is a good start, but it doesn't solve the problem. So how do we solve the remainder of the problem?
What would you put on the table as a really constructive second proposal on the heels of that?
There are a couple different issues, and the House Transportation Committee has been long at work on a very specific proposal, and that would say that if tax dollars that were paid at the pump, if every tax dollar that Michigan citizens paid when they went to the gasoline pump went to roads, we wouldn't have a problem. The problem, though, is some of those dollars goes to schools and local units of government. So I don't believe in solving one problem and creating others. I think, therefore, we have to solve the full problem. So if we just dedicate the tax dollars that are paid at the pump to roads, we're done with the roads issue. But we now have a schools and local government problem that we need to solve. And what is under discussion and what has been debated for a while, although not with a specific proposal, is there a tax or a sales tax increase, or are there other consumption or user-based solutions to that? And that's what's under debate.
Mike Rogers is scheduled to announce his intentions regarding his political future, possibly involving a run for the Senate from Michigan. What do you anticipate?
I'll be waiting to hear just like everybody else and very anxious to hear, quite frankly.
Would you be encouraged by his candidacy?
I would be.
Okay. But are you prepared to support Terry Lynn Land as your candidate, or would you prefer other people get involved?
Whether Representative or Congressman Rogers gets in tomorrow or not, I'm very interested. I will be very excited as we look at the Republican field because I believe the direction of Washington needs to change. Our nation is headed in the wrong direction while the state of Michigan is headed in the right direction. But I, at this point, do not anticipate picking which of our field. I will do that at a much later date.
You told M Live a couple of days ago that it is a, quote, struggle to try to come to a decision on how gays might be addressed in the state's Elliott Larson anti-discrimination law. Give us both sides of your thinking and what makes that a struggle?
The struggle is, I believe that we ought to respect and protect individuals. And now the struggle comes that I want to protect individuals who are gay. I want to protect individuals who have deeply held religious beliefs. So I want to respect the liberties of both. I want to respect individual liberties, and I want to respect and protect religious liberties. So as you go, as you look at Elliott Larson, if we're not careful, you would force churches and other private organizations to violate their personal religious beliefs. And I'm not interested in doing that. At the same time, I do want to respect and I want to protect individuals who are different than us, whether they're different because of the color of their skin, because of their religious beliefs, or because they're straight or gay. I believe everybody should be respected and protected.
We talked about Mike Rogers' political future. Let's talk about yours. What lay ahead as far as you're concerned?
I have a job I'm looking to do. I'm not looking to do to run for another job. I don't feel any obligation to run for other elected office. My wife and I will be newly empty nesters in the fall of 2014. We've got a blank slate, so I have no idea at this point what my future holds.
All right. Jace Bolger is the Speaker of the Michigan House. We appreciate your visit to Current State.
Good to be here.
Come back and see us. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Summer is nearly upon us, and that means music festival season throughout Michigan and across the Great Lakes region. Classical music abounds in our state and in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. WKAR's Jody Knoll, Mark Schwitzgable, and Peter Worf got together earlier this week to highlight some of the concerts in the coming weeks. Jody kicked things off.
Well, I want to start with a couple of camps, fine arts camps, Blue Lake and Interlaken. And one of the interesting things is that the opera department at Blue Lake is going to be conducted by Dr. James Niblock, who is MSU professor emeritus and is 95 years old now. And he's going to be conducting the staff in Georges Bizet's one-act comic opera, Dr. Miracle. I don't know if that's the doctor that James Niblock uses to keep him going so strong at age 95, but that's going to be performed throughout the summer. In addition, some other MSU connections, the Verdere Trio is going to be wrapping up their circuit of concerts as they celebrate their 40th anniversary this summer with a concert there in June. And then Walter Verdere and Friends, featuring a concert with Walter Verdere and violinist Ulf Holscher and Ken Beechler, WKAR alumnus, is going to be involved in a speaking role in that concert. That's also in June. Up in Interlaken, some interesting concerts spread throughout the summer. In June, on Sunday, June 30th, the World Youth Symphony Orchestra is going to be conducted by major conductor, American conductor, Joanne Folletta. Also this summer, Sylvia McNair will be performing in concert on July 12th and the Turtle Island Quartet on July 13th, all at Interlaken. Couple of festivals in northern Michigan that really are a little off the radar for most people. The Bayview Music Festival is in a beautiful setting on Lake Michigan on Little Traverse Bay, just very near Petoskey in the Bayview Association. And the Bayview Association dates back to the 19th century and was part of the National Chautauqua Movement of Adult Education. And from that, a music festival started and is considered the oldest chamber music festival in the country.
Really?
And the festival runs mid-June to mid-August, and there are literally dozens of performances throughout the summer, all the way from pop and jazz to classical, folk, and funk. And some of the interesting titles of some of the concerts that the faculty will be performing include on June 19th, The Gothic and the Godly, a majestic organ suite, a suite of folk songs, and a masterpiece by Ravel. On June 26th, Feminine Persuasion, after so many compositions by dead white European men, an evening of music featuring the talent of female composers and performers.
All right.
Sounds intriguing. And on July 10th, Bach, Brahms, and not Beethoven, but Bathsheba. Sounds like an interesting concert there. Then not far away, Baroque on Beaver. They use a lot of bees up there in northern Michigan.
Sure.
And Baroque on Beaver is a classical music festival that takes place on Lake Michigan's Beaver Island, which is 30 miles from the mainland. It's in its 12th year, and this year's festival takes place July 27th through Sunday, August 4th. Most of the concerts are free and open to the public, though donations are accepted and appreciated. And this year's concerts include a concert called Best of Baroque, one called Beaver Island Brass Quintet, and they're even going to have Christmas, not in July, but Christmas in August, with a Midsummer Noel, a choral spectacular. Visitors to Beaver Island either travel there by plane or boat, and unless you own your own plane or boat, you can use the scheduled air and ferry service available from Charlevoix.
That's WKAR's Jody Knoll, classical host and producer, with some of the classical music festivals going on up north and elsewhere throughout Michigan. Mark Schwitzgable is also on hand to talk more about Michigan classical music festivals. What do you have for us, Mark?
Well, one of the biggest chamber music festivals in the state is the Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival. This is a special year. It's the 20th annual Chamber Music Festival. The Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival got underway this past weekend, as a matter of fact, and will continue through the 23rd. It's 2 weeks of concerts in and around the Detroit area, plus performances in Ann Arbor, Brighton, and Windsor this year. No performances in the Lansing area, although they have in the past. The locations in Detroit include the Temple Bethel, Kirk of the Hills Presbyterian Church, St. Hugo of the Hills Catholic Church, the Seligman Performing Arts Center at Country Day School, and the Detroit Institute of Arts. James Toko has been the artistic director of the festival since its inception in 1994. Ruth Laredo, the great Detroit pianist, the late Ruth Laredo, has kind of been a guiding figure for this festival all these years. Some big names coming this year, three great pianists, all Americans, Jonathan Biss, Jeremy Denk, and Frederick Chu. There are also going to be world premieres of five commissioned works, and five ensembles will be performing, including the one that you know, Peter, from Chicago, 8th Blackbird, is going to be there, along with the Pacifica Quartet, the Jupiter Quartet, the Parker Quartet, and the Claremont Trio. Not only is this the 20th anniversary of the Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival, but it's a big year because the theme is Celebrate, marking the 75th birthdays of three great American composers, William Bolcom, John Harbison, and Joan Tower. On June 17th, Monday, at the Temple Bethel, there's going to be a composer's concert featuring works by all three of those composers at 7:30. And the next day, Tuesday the 18th, at Temple Bethel, there's going to be a Q&A with those composers led by Australian composer Brett Dean. Some of the other highlights of concerts coming up on June 13th, Thursday, at Kirk of the Hills, pretty good lineup here. James Toko, piano, Miriam Fried, violin, Paul Biss, viola, and Robert Demain, cello, going to be performing the Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1. Robert Demain, of course, was the principal cellist for the DSO, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, since 2002. He's now the principal with the LA Philharmonic. And by the way, that concert's going to be repeated Friday morning at 10:45. And then there's one concert at the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is nice because it's free with museum admission. And that's going to feature the Beethoven Piano Trio No. 2, featuring the Delphi Trio. And then this one is, I think, the most interesting one. June 19th, Wednesday, at Temple Bethel at 7:30, pianist Frederick Chu is going to be doing a recital called Classical Smackdown, Debussy versus Prokofiev. And he's got it arranged as four rounds, like a fight, of dueling pieces by each composer. That sounds pretty good. There are going to be a couple concerts in Ann Arbor at the Carytone Concert House on June 14th, Friday, featuring the Jupiter Quartet and cellist Paul Katz. There's also going to be a concert at Carytown the following Friday, June 21st, at 8 o'clock, Beethoven String Trio No. 3, with selected songs by William Bolcom, featuring soprano Lauren Skuess and William Bolcom at the piano. And then on Sunday the 23rd, a concert in the afternoon at 2 o'clock, featuring the Delphi Trio, Mozart Violin Sonata, two works by Elliot Carter, and Dvorak's Piano Trio No. 3. So lots of great concerts coming up. There's more information online at greatlakeschambermusic.org. Tickets available, either solo tickets or packages of tickets, so check that out.
Mark Schwitzgable with a few of the many concerts happening during this deep immersion of chamber music with the Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival all throughout southern and southeastern Michigan. Mark, thanks for that rundown. That's a look at some of the music happening around Michigan. Let me take you on a few day trips outside of Michigan to Indiana, to Ohio, and then to Illinois, especially the Chicago area. First, we'll visit one of the elite music schools in the country, Indiana University and the Jacobs School of Music. And their summer music series goes from June 14th until July 23rd, so still about a month to go. I'm going to try and pick an event or two that will represent sort of a day trip, because for most of these concerts, you'll pretty much have to drive 2, 3, maybe 4 hours, and you might even want to stay the night if it's an evening concert. So here's one of the main concerts happening at the Summer Music Festival at Indiana University. This is Friday, July 12, with the festival orchestra, David Efron conducting, and he will be joined by soprano Heidi Grant Murphy in a program of Strauss songs, the Overture to the School for Scandal by Samuel Barber, music of Benjamin Britten in this coming up on the 100th anniversary of his birth, some traditional music of the British Isles, and then sort of the main course on the menu, Richard Strauss's Ein Heldenleben, always a great orchestral showpiece to show off the Indiana Summer Music Festival Orchestra that's coming up on July 12. We'll shoot on over to Ohio, to really one of the great classical music cities in the country, Cincinnati, with such a deep tradition of German, Austrian orchestral playing. The Cincinnati Orchestra always reflects that. The Cincinnati Opera does as well in its 2013 season, which goes now through July 28th. I'll pick out of the five fully staged operas one of my very favorites. It's Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, one of the most sublime works in the opera repertoire. That's an excerpt from Der Rosenkavalier coming up on June 27th or June 29th. That's a Saturday if you want to make it a weekend trip. The 29th at 7:30 in the Music Hall with the Cincinnati Opera. Let's take a 3-hour, maybe 4-hour drive on a Friday afternoon to the Ravinia Festival in Highland Park, just north of Chicago, for one of the granddaddies of all music festivals. 122 events are happening.
Wow.
Yeah, in this year's Ravinia Festival. It's so hard to narrow that list down to just, two or three, but I'll try and do that for you just by picking, again, weekend events. On July 12th, you have the CSO opening their weekend with an all Beethoven program, Christoph von Dohnányi, and Emmanuel Ax at the piano.
Whoa.
With an all Beethoven program. You really can't go wrong with that one, again, on July 12th. And then I really like this one, and if you've got kids you like to take to symphony as well, one more from the CSO. It's The Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers suites being played in an entire evening's program, and of course they'll have the half a dozen or so big screens out on the lawn showing scenes from the Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers.
Sounds
like
a great concert.
It's going to be with the glory of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra playing that soundtrack live at the Ravinia Festival, Friday, August 16th. That's at 7:30. Most of those within a few hours' drive, and we've had a listen to some of the Michigan Classical Music Summer Festivals. Thanks to Jody Knoll. Thanks very much.
Looking forward to taking in some of those concerts this summer.
Me too. And Mark Schwitzgable, thanks a lot for the review of the concerts.
Yeah, Great Lakes is really kind of the signature chamber music festival in Southeast Michigan, and great lineup this time too, so definitely worth checking out.
For Jody and Mark, this is Peter Worf for Current State.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Lansing's 20th annual Juneteenth celebration starts today. It's a time for African Americans to celebrate their emancipation from slavery after the U.S. Civil War. Here to tell us more about the history of this holiday and what will be happening to celebrate it in mid-Michigan is Cheryl Benjamin. She's a board member of the Lansing Juneteenth Committee. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for coming in. For people who aren't familiar with the history, please tell us how Juneteenth became a holiday and what exactly it celebrates.
Well, in January 1st of 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which you also know this is the 150th year of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Okay, yeah.
And 2 years later, which is June 19th in 1865, the news spread to Galveston, Texas. And the Frees were informed that you were indeed free. And from there, the celebration started, the initial celebrations of Juneteenth and freedom and what it meant for African Americans.
Is it known how long it should have taken? I mean, how long in the middle of the 19th century, how long? It shouldn't have taken 2 years for the word to get there. Were hurdles erected to this news then? I mean, that has to be, I assume that's the case.
That's news to me. I don't know how the news was delivered.
That's a book waiting to be written, it would seem to me. Tell us what happens here in Lansing.
In Lansing, we have a 3-day festival. We originated as originally a 1-day festival. We are the 18th state to come on board with the legislature through Public Act 48 to be the Juneteenth Freedom Festival Day, and we recognize it officially on the third Saturday of June.
Okay.
So our festival begins today. It's already started, the prayer breakfast with the Legislative Black Caucus. We'll have our lunch, and this is our government day. This evening at 5:30, we will be at Lansing City Hall, and Reverend Dr. Brumfield from Detroit Oak Grove AME Church will be here as our speaker. And we will also be recognizing the children which we had an essay contest. Those youth will be honored for submitting their works and participating in our contest.
And what is you are a member, you're a board member of the committee.
Correct.
What do you have your fingers on exactly? What do you do?
I have my fingers and a touch of a little bit of everything.
I knew you were going to say that.
I do. I help them with the public relations, the editing, the background. I do a lot in the background, making sure our committee stays gelled. I participate with the Greater Lansing Festival Association, so that way we're starting to network with our partners in the community.
Do you find that awareness of what Juneteenth commemorates do people generally know about that little historical fact or not?
They know the beginning. They may know that, yes, there was the Emancipation Proclamation.
Right. Sure.
Yes, because of family ties, and a lot of Michiganders have people who came from down south. They may be familiar with there was a festival, but they may not know exactly what that meant and how it grew to be what it is now.
One of the attractions at this year's celebration is a Negro League tribute baseball game. Tell us about that.
Correct. One of the things that originated with this festival was a traditional baseball game. We commemorate it by having a softball game. Reverend Dr. Clyde Carnegie, who is from Lansing, is going to give our ceremonial first pitch. And we have community teams that participate and do a baseball game. And while the baseball game is going on, we have a DJ and music going in between. But also tomorrow, we will present our first hip-hop explosion. And that's coming into town. And we're going to welcome in Teen Sway, all of the above Hip-Hop Academy, and our headliner will be the hip-hop team Crucial Creations. And we want to welcome them into town.
And when and where does the baseball game take place?
St. Joe Park, 6 o'clock p.m. until 8:30 p.m.
And the hip-hop event?
Starts at 7 o'clock p.m. through 8:30 p.m.
Anything else going on here on your agenda?
Yes, we will have vendors, and the festivities will get underway. And as we move to Saturday, we open at 11 o'clock a.m. And we have our health fair, which is Sparrow Hospital and McLaren Healthcare System, who participate in our health fair from 11 to 3. We will have concerts all day, dance teams. And we want to let you know that we're going to close with two of Lansing's own, which is Oric Ewing on bass guitar, who also he played in the Jazz Fest 2 years ago, and he's also been with us last year as our headliner. But coming home will be Tim Cunningham.
Oh, yeah.
The sax man.
Everybody knows Tim.
And he will be with us. So they will close our evening out on Saturday.
Juneteenth is the celebration. Day one is today, and Cheryl Benjamin is a board member of the Lansing Juneteenth Committee. Have fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow on Current State, we welcome Lansing Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon. Also, we have a Father's Day essay from our occasional food contributor, Maureen Abood. That and more Friday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Instroth is the producer of Current State. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Emmanuel Berry for production, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.